is a small country, thousands of miles away. But if what is happening there is important to every American. On Sunday, June 25th, communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. This attack has made it clear beyond all doubt that the international communist movement is vision to conquer independent nations. An act of aggression such as this creates a very real danger to the security of all free nations. The attack upon Korea was an outright breach of the peace and a violation of the Charter. By their actions in Korea, communist leaders have demonstrated their contempt for the basic moral principles on which the United Nations is founded. This is a direct challenge to the efforts of free nations to build the kind of world in which men can live in freedom and peace. This challenge has been presented squarely. We must meet it squarely.
I don't believe the Chinese people want war. They've had enough of it during the past 20 years. We want to see them getting on with the immense task of raising the standard of life of the millions of people in their own country. It's for them to choose their own form of government. We only ask that they should concede to other peoples, such as the Koreans, the Indochinese, the Tibetans, and the rest, the same rights which they claim for themselves. Aggression has started again in the Far East. If the aggressor gets away with it, aggressors all over the world will be encouraged. The same results which led to the Second World War will follow, and another world war may result. This is why what is happening in Korea is of such importance to you. The fire that has been started in distant Korea may burn down your house.
When we arrived at Busan, we were welcomed by the brigade commander and our advance parties who'd flown ahead. With them also to greet us was a Negro military band, a deputation of South Korean worthies, all dressed in long white clothes and their funny black hats. But with them also was a girls' choir who gaily sang God Save the King, which we believe they only learnt the night before.
We were the first of the United Nations forces to arrive in the country, and we were needed as things were going badly for the Americans, who'd been pushed back to bridgehead round the port of Busan and were being very hard pressed by the North Koreans. Life in the bridgehead was always exciting. There were not enough troops to hold the front, and the North Koreans attacked continuously. There were always large gaps in our line, and I think that we were lucky at times not to have been cut off and surrounded.
We were put into the line on the Nakhon River. The situation was still what you might call in the cowboy phase. No one really knew what was going on. One company, for an example, had D Company, had 10,000 yards of front to look after. And between ourselves, on the left flank, were the Argyles. Between them and the next American troops were a gap of about 5-6 miles, I suppose.
In the beginning, it was extremely difficult to know really where the enemy were, and the intelligence organization must have had a very difficult time. Even so, we kept on feeling that they were having very bad dreams, and in a sort of twilight of reality, they were sending on their reports to us. Very soon after we arrived, I had to take over 4.5 miles of front line along a river. I had to cover this area, my company of a little over 100, and some South Korean police. I didn't care very much for the look of them. And so I suppose I can be forgiven for being a little bit sensitive about who was facing me. This used to vary from day to day by as much as 3 divisions. And I can remember one night, about 8 o'clock, receiving a telephone message to say that an enemy armored brigade, which included about 150 tanks, were at that very moment trying to bridge the river with sandbags and were about to rush through me. I reinforced the area with one bazooka and one Bren gun, which is all I could afford.
United Nations forces were briefed for the defense, and the first tasks fell to the United States Air Force. Supported by the Royal Navy and its carrier aircraft, super fortresses ranged deep into North Korean territory, striking heavily at the invaders' supply points and communications. From America, in the early days of the land fighting, came the 45-ton General Pershing tank. Its crews found that it proved an effective opponent of the North Korean armor, which, on capture, turned out to include many vehicles with Soviet markings, as well as Russian-built guns. In a few weeks, the defenders were compressed into one small corner of Southeast Korea around the port of Pusan. Everything depended on the port of Pusan and the ships that came there. The breakout from the perimeter was preceded by one of the biggest airstrikes of the war. The bombs of the superfortresses went down in raid after raid on North Korean railway yards and ports. Bundles of leaflets instead of bombs were loaded onto other aircraft. The enemy was warned about the offensive and was called on to use this safe conduct pass to surrender or face the full consequences. 3 million leaflets carried the United Nations message, and for days on end, they were scattered far and wide with their warning and their offer. Behind the warning lay a tactical masterstroke, a left hook, a seaborne landing on the beaches of Incheon, the port of Seoul. An intense naval bombardment opened the assault, with General MacArthur himself directing the invasion, to be carried out by American Marines, supported by United States and British warships.
And somehow it came off. But not, of course, without those moments of peculiar lunacy that were by now coming to characterize the war in Korea.
There were, of course, moments of utter fantasy, unbelievable moments like the one on Invasion D-Day, with the bay at Incheon suddenly surging with warships and rocket ships and landing craft and amphibious tanks and every known engine of war. And there, careering around in the middle of it all, if you can credit such a thing, a boat marked in huge letters Press, full of disputing and terrified correspondents. And then this fabulous craft finding itself, through some extravagant mischance, away in front of the assault fleet, unable to get out of the way, having to land ahead of the Marines. I was in that boat, so I remember it pretty well. I think I would have enjoyed it more if I hadn't been almost too terrified to move.
General MacArthur put off in the Fleet Admiral's barge with the landing forces. Intricate timing to catch the exceptional tides at Incheon brought them ashore according to plan, and the beachhead was secured.
The day I landed in Taegu, bouncing most hideously onto the runway in a C-47 overloaded with 40-millimeter cannon shells, that was one of the darkest days of all. The roads were full of refugees, the air was full of forebodings. The enemy was forcing onward so fast that he'd already got a kind of invincible aura around him. Then when I left the other day, tossing round the edge of a yellow sea typhoon in a rocket ship, the front was wide open. An alarming thought on the whole. I don't think there's any historical precedent for a war flipping so quickly over from disaster to conquest. It's made it extremely hard for some of us to adjust our reactions to the changing scene. Certainly no war could ever have been more diligently chronicled. Sometimes it seemed you could scarcely see Korea for correspondence. We did the best we could to tell the tale. But all we could do was suggest a few more arrows on the map, a few more battles in the abstract, a catalogue of obscure Oriental names that no one could remember anyhow. There was Kyongsan and Pohangdong and Walmido and Ingangni and the deadly road we called the bowling alley, where everything that moved was shelled, and the beaches of Incheon, full of 3.5 rockets and cartons of Coca-Cola. They convey nothing now. They've been left far behind. But only the other day they filled our horizon, as they were bound to do for men with their heads so close to the earth. They are just names, not symbols. One doesn't remember names as one remembered Alamin or Arnhem, or even, as it turned out, Dunkirk. And the names don't hint at what seemed to me the really memorable things. The unique and ghastly smell of a Korean rice field, the miles of blinding, abrasive dust, the abandoned schools, the baby crying by the ruined shack. To me, at any rate, this is an especially beastly and disgusting war in conditions that have no glamour at all. The fundamental irony, of course, was that the world's first United Nations campaign of honour should have been waged in such a place. Korea is a dismal country. At least I found it a repulsive country. Of all the 40 or 50 lands I've seen, it is perhaps quite the most difficult to like. True, there was a first brief moment on the early road from Taegu north when it had a sort of feeling of the Pyrenees, brown eroding hillsides with sprawling rice paddies instead of vineyards. You felt a passing visual impression of beauty until the smells overcame it and the squalor and the pervading sense of doubt that seemed to seep from every rock and turn of the road.
The war for us was essentially a war of movement. And for many, many weeks after breaking out from the Nakhtong bridgehead, we and the other units of the 8th Army moved north. At times it almost seemed like a race. We, however, having no transport of our own, were in the role of hitchhikers. And if we went marching, we rode on tanks or on guns or traveled in borrowed US transport. And wherever we went on the ground, we drove through a blinding clouds of dust. By the 24th of November, American Thanksgiving Day, we found ourselves some 40 miles from the Yalu River, that boundary that runs between North Korea and the Manchurian border. The roads were littered with signs, unit signs, brigade signs, showing where a unit in front had moved. At the same time, chalked on the wall, villages, was the slogan, Kilroy was here. After a time, we got ahead, and one day I saw on the side of a house, chalked in large white letters, the slogan, the Mids can say with glee and joy that they were here before Kilroy.
One morning I was called into American camp and was offered some breakfast. And they led me away to their chow hall, as they call it. And I queued up there with the rest of the Yanks there. I grabbed my tray as I went past, expecting a nice, decent breakfast. First of all, I think it was an egg come flying over and landed on the tray, and then a lovely piece of bacon. I thought to myself, well, I'm going to enjoy this. That was followed by some sort of cake, flapjacks, I think they call them. And I looked at that, I didn't know what it was, but I thought, well, I'll try it. And I carried on, and, well, as luck had it, I was looking the other way. And some chap immediately got hold of a big spoonful of syrup and spread it over the lot. Well, that was one of the worst breakfasts I ever had. Egg and bacon smothered in syrup.
About eight of our boys went out. Nine consecutive nights, and cut a telephone line in the Chinese lines and hoped the signaller would come and mend them. But he never did. But the 10th night, he came. They jumped on him, then they had him prisoner. Well, then, of course, they had to get back to their own lines across No Man's Land, about a mile of it. And dawn was breaking. As they started off, the Chinaman started shouting. Well, now, of course, if he'd given the show away, all our eight boys would have been in the bag, and that would be the end of that. So they had to keep him quiet somehow and yet get him back to our lines. So they posted one man to walk behind him, and every time the Chinese soldier shouted, they hit him on the head. And this little procession wended its way across No Man's Land, and all the way across, the Chinaman shouted, and then there was a tremendous clap on the back of his head from the soldier walking behind. And this shout, bang, went on all across No Man's Land, till at last they got into our own lines, and it was only then they realized that what the Chinaman was shouting was, "Don't keep hitting me on the head."
One of the great troubles, which probably has some significance, was the absence of interpreters. I spent some time in a Korean training center watching the induction of recruits. They turn a Korean civilian into a soldier in exactly 5.5 days now. And my interpreter, a young lieutenant who claimed most remarkably to be a teacher of English at Taegu College, turned out to know about 7 words, almost all the useless ones. He insisted, for example, that the thing my colleague carried round his neck for taking pictures with was a telephone. Nothing I could say would shake that belief. So, in the end, I gave up, as you always do, and for the rest of the time, we were taking photographs with a telephone.
The wind was an enemy you didn't even begin to think of facing, only of avoiding. There was a rotation of wind and calm. After 2 or 3 days of ordinary, calm, cold weather, when there might well be snow, the wind, a northwest one straight from Siberia, would begin to blow. This wind lowered the real air temperature often as much as 10 or 15 degrees, but its effect on the skin was as if the thermometer had suddenly sunk 50 degrees. And it created fear, a quite generalized fear which sapped every kind of morale. I've stood in this wind feeling so small and helpless that I was ready to cry with self-pity. 30 minutes was the absolute limit of a sentry's usefulness when the wind was blowing.
Remember, in the morning, without any warning, there was a sort of sigh in the distance. And then the wind from the north, from Siberia, came on us, howling and screaming, and there was no escape from it anywhere. Vehicles froze to the ground. Even the antifreeze failed to protect cylinder heads. Our water bottles froze at our side. It was impossible to open tin food because they were like concrete. There's really no getting away from it. I remember an Australian turned to me and saying, "A bit of old mother-in-law's breath."
We had always found ourselves in the van, in the stages, moving north. Now I took on the role of rear guard. And we, from our positions on the hills or in the passes, used to see vast columns of troops moving back very fast in their vehicles. One night I asked a sentry if he'd seen a lot of movement during the night. And he said, "Yes, sir. They're moving real fast. Last night a lot of them colored chaps went through. And they were all sitting in their vehicles, and really their cigars looked just like tracer bullets in the night."
We were given the job of holding open a road for the American division to come through. It was all mysteriously quiet. There was no firing going on at all, until suddenly, around the bend at the top end of the pass, came one single jeep. I remember it quite well. It was careering down the road from side to side, and then suddenly the whole hillside that was facing this particular road seemed to light up, and it showed only too plainly that the Chinese were in possession of the pass. The next thing that came through was some American tanks, until finally the main body of the Americans decided to drive down the road in their vehicles about four abreast. What happened was quite obvious. The leading vehicles were shot up, and they blocked the road completely. And there was the whole entire transport, guns, and the majority of the tanks of the division stuck, and they lost a lot.
There's one particularly tragic moment that I can remember. We were streaming southwards in the withdrawal, south of the North Korean capital of Pyongyang, and the convoy halted for a short time, and in front of me was a truckload of South Korean soldiers. And on the side of the road, amongst a small crowd of refugees, was a young man and a young wife and two children and a load of bedding, which is all they had really got in their possession. The South Korean soldiers offered them a lift, and they threw onto the truck their only possession, their bedding. And at that moment, the convoy moved on and left them behind. And the last I saw of them was standing on the side of the road, now without anything, with the first flakes of snow drifting past them.
A thin layer of ice and frozen snow lies over the sand. The distant mountains are grey-white. The unbearable wind moans across this desert flat, whipping up the dust and ice crystals. And you can see the refugee column moving across the footbridge and the motor bridge, where the ice flows clink in the river as the pontoons move under the trucks. Across the dusty flats and over the river's second reach, which is frozen hard, and then along the raised road and towards the railway station 3 miles away at Yongdongpo. A typical woman in the column carries her movable possessions done up in a bit of bright green or violet silk on her head. Her baby is fastened to her back by a crimson kilt tied round her waist, and she leads by the hand two children with faces as red as polished apples in this blistering cold. These children shuffle along, bent under their own bundles, taking three steps to their mother's one. At Yongdongpo, a vast crowd packs the railway station and the ground for 50 yards around it. All the seats in the train are free now, if they can be got, and the refugees are sitting there until they get one. Some of them have been there for more than 24 hours. Two trains are standing in the station, trains of up to 30 huge open Japanese goods trucks, twice the size of English ones. These open trucks are piled with bundles and packed with people, and all over the great black engine, refugees are swarming too, with their luggage. One of the trains has been standing in the station for 5 hours. As the television cameraman and I sat watching this scene in our jeep, a little girl about 7 years old and possibly 3 feet high, with her bundle on her back and her bright dress exactly like a Japanese doll, steps out of the gutter, bows formally, and says in good English, "Please may I come with you to Taegu?" There's nothing we can say except that we're not going there. And when this harsh reply brings tears, there's nothing we can do about that either. For this child, need is for security, freedom from fear, and shelter from the bitter cold. And all we have to offer is a sweet ration.
And it became clear that even if they were not intervening officially, the government at Beiping were actively supporting the North Korean aggressors, not only with arms, but also with men. It is true, I know, that the Central People's Government of the People's Republic of China maintain that these men are volunteers. But whether they are technically volunteers or not, it seems certain that they are indistinguishable from armed formations. At any rate, that is the opinion of our United Nations Unified Command.
We were static. They were mobile. We were anchored to the roads because we were scared to leave our transport. They were nimble and subtle, and dissolved into the hills around us. We would travel safely enough along a road at noon. An hour later, there might be no retreat. The road was blocked, an ambush laid. One's friend, who had hurried too casually back, was now lying quietly in a ditch, staring blindly at the sun. How often we checked over that Korean maxim, never ride the lonely road, above all at sundown, for dusk is when the little men melt into the mountains. Night is the enemy.